From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, big business stepping away from Donald Trump.
This was a president who was supposed to be a business-friendly president. He was a CEO, the first real CEO president the country's ever really had, who came out of business directly. And he's lost them already.
East Lansing and Michigan State University at odds over the city's push for a new personal income tax.
Like every other community in the state of Michigan, you know, we have very few tools in the toolbox to address our financial issues.
Democrat Bill Cobbs, the former Xerox executive who wants to be your next governor.
Governing is really about providing leadership, providing vision, being able to develop a plan that's executable, and having the conviction to see it through to the end.
Those stories and more today on Stateside, but first, the news. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. What can a city do when facing a $200 million debt? One option, raise taxes. And that's why the city of East Lansing has drawn up an income tax proposal for the November ballot. If approved by voters, residents would pay a 1% tax on their income. Non-residents who work in the city would pay 0.5%. And that has put East Lansing in direct conflict with Michigan State University, which feels its employees, including students, would be forced to pay an unfair chunk of that income tax. With us now is East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows. Welcome to the program, Mayor.
Thanks for having me.
Mary, there have been a lot of communications back and forth in recent weeks between you and MSU President Luana Simon. How would you sum up what the offers and counteroffers are about?
Just business. That's how I would sum them. The president made an offer to us, which was very attractive, that would have as a condition that we would drop our request that the voters determine whether they were going to have an income tax authorized in the city. And they were cordial and I think very professional. And it's kind of the relationship that we've always had with the university.
What led to this $200 million debt?
Well, you know, it's very interesting. This is really, you know, our debt, what I would call a traditional debt. In other words, money that we have borrowed and that on an annual basis or on a quarterly basis, we're making payments with regard to is really about $69 million. The remainder of that money is money that is associated with the legacy costs that the city has. And so in the old days, so to speak, you know, we wouldn't even be reporting this. But after Enron, every community in the country has had to change their policies and start to report their unfunded liability towards their pension and retiree health care obligations. So most of that money is that. And the money that we're seeking is money that we will be devoting primarily to reducing that debt.
Those legacy costs, it's something municipalities all over Michigan are really wrestling with, isn't it?
It is. And actually, we're not the only one who is studying the income tax. I think Ann Arbor is. Kalamazoo was, but Kalamazoo found an angel. I think they've got a $500 million endowment that they've been given in exchange for not imposing an income tax. And I think that if MSU wants to do that for us, we'll be right there with them.
You're happy to welcome an angel.
Yes.
And I know the East Lansing Financial Health Review team studied the problem, drafted this income tax recommendation. Did it consider any other ways to address the debt, particularly these legacy costs?
Yes, actually we did, because the state also has a provision that allows communities to actually borrow money to pay off their legacy costs. Essentially, you borrow the money at a low rate of interest and you earn a greater rate of interest, and that way you pay off the debt and you address the unfunded liability. That doesn't really work for us, and it doesn't really work in most of the state of Michigan, because the pension and legacy costs are largely related to police and fire, and police and fire have been very resistant to going to a defined contribution system. So our police and fire are not on a defined contribution system. All of our other employees are. So the simple fact is we don't have a way of negotiating out of that. There's another, you know, law in the state of Michigan, Act 312, which also militates against us being able to accomplish that. That's a condition of being able to go on this bonding route. So that didn't really work for us. And like every other community in the state of Michigan, you know, we have very few tools in the toolbox to address our financial issues. We can have a city income tax. We can do property tax. That's about it. We don't have any options in between. The state has constitutional revenue sharing, which gives us a portion of the first 4 cents of the sales tax. But, you know, we don't have any way of ensuring that the state will actually fund what's called statutory revenue sharing. And that's been reduced dramatically, not just for us, but for every other community in the state of Michigan as well.
And I know, Mary, you mentioned police and fire services and how your hands are kind of tied there. And am I correct that Michigan State University costs East Lansing for public works, police and fire about $3.75 million in a given year in uncompensated costs?
That is the result of a financial report that the financial health team requested to have done, and the report indicates that. There's an interesting aspect to this. The financial health team really was largely populated by MSU employees or people associated with the Michigan State University, so they asked for this report to be done. We're confident that the report is accurate. I think the university has said it's a cherry-picked report, so we do have that dispute going, but you know, we have to rely on the information that we're provided. There's another aspect of this income tax, though. The income tax, you know, Lansing has an income tax, so the university already has employees that are paying an income tax. And their medical school was moved to Grand Rapids, which has an income tax. So it has been a little bit confusing as to why they would think this is such a bad thing.
And I know that in letters back and forth over the last few weeks, President Luana K. Simon and you have been going back and forth trying to negotiate over an amount that the university might pay to keep the proposal off the November ballot. So far, no agreement?
So far, no agreement. You know, we asked them to reconsider our last offer to them, which would have a much smaller income tax, even though it's small to begin with, and a guaranteed payment from them for about 10 years. So we'll see, you know, if maybe they do reconsider that. I don't think there's any indication that we're going to get a response to that, though.
Mayor, some people might hear about this and maybe see this as something like a bribe, like for a certain amount of money from MSU, we will not go down the path of an income tax. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, I guess that I leave it to them to interpret it any way they want. I saw it as more of an offer of revenue to the city, a steady revenue, for a temporary decision to not go forward with an income tax. The original offer was a five-year offer. They moved that to a 10-year offer. We went back and forth, as you know, with a seven-year offer, an eight-year offer. It just never really moved off this total of $20 million. That doesn't really help us. And $2 million a year from the university doesn't really address this issue of the pension funding. We need more money to go in on an annual basis and be assured that we can do that in order to really turn it around. Cities in the state of Michigan who have these pension obligations, who happen to be part of the municipal employees retirement system, that system suffered greatly during the downturn in the economy, and it's got to get back on its feet. And so if we don't get this done early, at some point we'll be paying all of our property tax revenue into this fund. We need to avoid that.
President Simon has called this taxation without representation for some 14,000 university employees, Mayor. Many of them are students. Many of them are work study. Doesn't this income tax proposal hit young students who are already financially stretched very, very hard?
Well, that also is an interesting statement because at least these people will have an opportunity to vote on it. So it isn't really taxation without representation. I mean, if they're employees who live in other communities who work at Michigan State University, they'll be just like myself, who worked in the city of Lansing for 28 years and paid a Lansing city income tax. I never got to vote on it. You know, I didn't really feel that it was an imposition on me. During the time I was there, I was receiving police protection, fire protection, all of these expensive services that the city was providing. So I feel sort of that same way about that. As far as students go, students will have an opportunity to vote on this. I think that's an important thing. That's not taxation without representation. It has a very small impact on them. A student who would earn $4,000 a year, let's say, which I think is the average amount of a working student on campus, because most students don't work, that amount would be like $40 a year, or if they were a non-resident, $20 a year. I don't think that's a major imposition. And the other part of that is they don't get to vote on tuition increases. In 2000, tuition at Michigan State University was about $152 a credit hour. Today, it's $482 a credit hour. Nobody got to vote on any of that. And in fact, that comprises, it's about $960 million of their $1.3 billion budget. So the university has the opportunity to address the problems that it may face in terms of finances by simply raising taxes on its citizens every year. We don't have that option. No community in Michigan does.
Mayor, the state deadline to alter ballot language for the November proposal has come and gone. Are you still negotiating with Michigan State, and what are your options at this point?
The options at this point are just a single option, which is to remove it from the ballot. And that applies to any ballot proposal up until the time the thing gets printed to be mailed out. So there's time. But I really don't expect that we'll get any offer from the university.
Okay. And if I'm not mistaken, it's like a September 23rd deadline to get that ballot mailed to military and overseas voters. So you're
correct.
Looking at just a
That's
few weeks.
That's correct, yeah.
Earlier in our conversation, you kind of touched on the longtime relationship between East Lansing and Michigan State. And in just about every college town in this country, there are tensions between the local municipality and its residents and the university, you know, which more than likely doesn't pay much in the way of local taxes. How would you characterize MSU as an East Lansing citizen over the years?
I think it's been actually a very good citizen. You know, I think we have our financial issues relating to the university, but we also are partners on a whole host of things, probably close to 150 different programs in which Michigan State University and the city partner to accomplish. So I can't say they have been a bad partner. I can say that they've been a little tight-fisted in the last few years, but I'm hoping that we can make a change there.
East Lansing Mayor Mark Meadows, thanks so much for speaking with us, Mr. Mayor.
Happy to do so.
And we reached out to the administration at Michigan State University to share their perspective on Stateside. They did not take us up on the offer. Coming up, what's in store for us during Monday's total eclipse of the sun?
At the point where it's the greatest eclipse for Michigan, it's going to be around 80%.
That comes up in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The businessman president seems to be losing big business. Donald Trump's promise to turn to America's business leaders for advice and counsel has collapsed. His refusal to lay complete blame for the weekend violence in Charlottesville led to a revolt by CEOs in his business advisory groups. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with us. And Daniel, as we know, the president pumped out a tweet on Wednesday. I'm quoting him now. Rather than putting pressure on the business people of the Manufacturing Council and Strategy and Policy Forum, I am ending both. Thank you all! Exclamation point. But didn't the CEOs break up with the president before he sent out that tweet?
Yeah, I was going to say he had it backwards. It's the CEOs who are putting pressure on him. There's no question about it. Both of the councils were having conference calls earlier in the day. There was a scramble on Tuesday night to try and get together a conference call way after business hours, like 11 o'clock at night. They weren't able to do it. They scheduled one for Wednesday morning. Stephen Schwartzman, who is at Blackstone, who's actually a friend of the president's, convened the strategy forum, which Mary Barr from General Motors sits on. She was on the call. All the other people were on the call. And our reporting and others' reporting pretty much has put together a story or a picture in which they went around the horn, so to speak. Everybody had their say. And ultimately what they agreed to do was to what they called disband and condemn. So they issued a statement that was under Schwartzman's name, essentially, but on behalf of that council, saying that they didn't support this. I mean, I think this is a real interesting and potentially very damaging development for the White House. This was a president who was supposed to be a business-friendly president. He was a CEO, the first real CEO president the country's ever really had who came out of business directly. And he's lost them already, 7 months into his presidency. And I think it's going to be a lot harder for him to get them back in any meaningful way to the extent that he would want them.
Do you think the fact that he's being rebuked by the other business leaders, do you think that hit him harder than and his agenda harder than the heat he's taking from other politicians or the public?
Maybe, but I mean, look, these were people that expected an agenda to be executed by a Republican president who was a CEO and by Republican Congress. And it's not happening. Healthcare has been an abysmal failure, healthcare reform, that is. And now they're saying we're going to go on to tax reform. And you listen to people who know Washington and know the situation. I think a lot of people think that any kind of grand tax reform is likely not going to happen. This is going to be one of the greatest situations of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory politically that we've seen in modern times. Mm. And I think it's probably going to get worse before it gets better.
Well, probably not helped by the fact that as we talk today, he's slamming Lindsey Graham and Jeff Flake, senators who are in his party, who voted for his stuff, slamming them on Twitter.
Yeah, I think this president really believes that the tactics he used in the campaign as a candidate will work as a sitting president. He's coming up against institutional forces, the likes of which he did not anticipate. He's not the king. He won't be the king. He has to deal with the American institutions. And by the way, that includes corporate America, who does not, as a general proposition, answer to the President of the United States. And I think what you saw in the last couple of days was CEOs who were looking at this and surveying the landscape here and said, we want to get out of here. So it's interesting that the president, at the end of that tweet, he thanked them. And as I said in my column today, it's the CEOs who should be thanking the president because he's essentially released them. And I think a lot of them probably didn't, the longer this went on, certainly the Charlottesville issue, but other issues that they saw happening or the inability of this administration to move ahead with an agenda. It was like, you know, we got other things to do. We'd rather not be associated, you know, publicly with this. And the other thing is that there were constituent groups, particularly for consumer-facing companies like a General Motors, as an example, who were starting to turn up the pressure and starting to say, you need to dissociate yourself from this president. And these CEOs knew that was coming, and they knew that was an issue. And this question was, how long can we withstand that? And I think what happened in Charlottesville and his comments on Tuesday and then him releasing them is probably the best thing that could have happened to them.
I will note, when we saw the names of the CEOs who began to resign almost immediately after the Charlottesville retrenching when he came out on Tuesday, you know, Merck and Under Armour and Intel and Campbell Soup and 3M and, of course, AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, Mary Barra's name wasn't on that list.
No, but I think she was probably, from what I understand, was kind of moving in that direction. Remember, too, of all of those sectors that are represented by those various businesses, I think the one sector arguably that has gotten the most presidential attention early on has been the auto industry. The president has been very interested in that. It's ironic that all this happens yesterday on the day that the U.S. opens renegotiation talks over NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. That's a huge issue to the auto industry. How is that going to play out? How is it going to impact our very complicated global supply chain? How is it going to affect pricing on vehicles, tariffs, import duties, you know, the whole nine yards? At the same time, you've got this administration that said, hey, we're going to go back and reinstitute some of the agreements over fuel economy rules that the Obama administration on their way out the door changed unilaterally. So that's also very important to the industry. So they've got a lot of issues right before this administration, and how they play that is going to be critical. And I think they're, one of the wild cards is always, are we going to get on the wrong side of the president and get into a Twitter war with him because we abandon this manufacturing council, or in this case, the strategy forum that Mary Barra was on?
In the meantime, you can't have it both ways. You're either on the right side of history or the side that appears to support neo-Nazis and white supremacists. And even this morning, the president comes in with a series of tweets condemning the push to remove, in his words, beautiful statues and monuments to the Confederacy. I mean,
that's going to be a losing battle, I think. He can say that, but I think ultimately that what you're seeing happen is going to continue to happen.
People are looking for leaders to call him out by name, for instance. Don't do a mealy-mouthed, we condemn racism. How do you do that and still hope to work with him?
Well, that's the issue. And at the end of the day, these CEOs do not work for these amorphous voices on Twitter. They work for a board of directors who are answerable to the shareholders. That's their first duty. And to the extent that they saw that the association with President Trump was going to impinge on that relationship and their duties, they were starting to push away from it. But picking a fight with the White House is over this kind of thing is probably not advisable for a lot of them to do that. And there are going to be people who are going to be disappointed and saying you need to take a more courageous stand. And some companies can do that. based upon, for example, Under Armour. It sells athletic gear. It has a lot of sponsored athletes, many of whom are African-American. You know, you could make the argument, we need to take a stand. We need to be very public about this, because if we don't, that impinges on our business. Other companies can look at it a little differently.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
There's been a lot of buzz about the upcoming Great American Total Solar Eclipse. It's happening Monday, the 21st, and astronomers say this one is worth the hype. Let's figure out just what we will see here in Michigan as we say hello to Dr. Shannon Schmall, who directs the Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State University. It's good to have you with us and to talk about this event everyone's buzzing about.
Thanks for having me.
How excited are you personally about what's coming on Monday?
I think the best way to describe it is if you know the meme on the internet of Kermit the Frog flailing before the Muppet Show starts, that's me.
Oh, yeah.
So,
I mean, when we think about, you know, we're talking about it's been basically a century since this has happened.
Yes, it's been about a century since we've had one go from coast to coast. The last one that has hit the continental United States was 1979. So it's even been a long time since we've had any total solar eclipse hit the continental U.S.
And just to kind of give us some astronomy 101, tell us exactly what is happening with this total solar eclipse.
So during a total solar eclipse, what's happening is the moon is going to go directly in between the Earth and the sun. And this happens every 29 days when we have a new moon. But normally, because the moon's orbit is tilted by about 5 degrees from the Earth's orbital plane, we see it a little bit above or below the sun. But this time it's going to be crossing right into that plane, and it's going to be directly in front of the sun. And that will cast a shadow onto the Earth. So as long as you're underneath the darkest part of that shadow, you're going to see a total solar eclipse.
Those are the lucky folks in that path of totality.
Yes, from Oregon to South Carolina.
And that means what exactly if you're in the path of totality?
So if you are in the path of totality, the moon will completely cover the sun's main disk. And so for you in that path, when that happens, that totality, which lasts up to 2.5 minutes or so, I think 2 minutes, 41 seconds at the greatest number, the sky is going to go dark. The temperature may drop. You'll be able to see stars and planets during the day. So some winter constellations will be up that we normally only see in December and November and so on. And you'll be able to see the outermost atmosphere of the sun called the corona. So that's only in the path of totality, though.
And that is not Michigan. So here in Michigan, what will we see or what won't we see?
So here in Michigan, we're going to see a partial eclipse. So at the point where it's the greatest eclipse for Michigan, it's going to be around 80%, give or take, depending on exactly where you are in the state. So for the greater Lansing area, for instance, it's going to be around 80%. You're going to see the moon go in front of the sun, and you'll see sort of a crescent shape of the sun when that happens. But you won't see the sky go dark. You won't see the temperature drop and that sort of thing.
Because we're all wondering if we might see weird or unique natural phenomenon or animals responding in some strange way during the eclipse.
Yeah, I believe there's been some studies that have been done in the past with animals in the path of totality where some interesting behaviors have happened where they either go into their nighttime routines or they get scared in some sort of way because they don't know what's happening. But we probably won't see anything like that here in Michigan.
Oh, bummer. That would be fun. But let's talk about the importance of knowing how to watch the eclipse, the do's and don'ts. So what's the biggest don't?
Don't look directly at the sun, ever.
Ever. Yeah.
The only time you can look directly at the sun without any sort of eye protection is during totality in that path of totality. So here in Michigan, at no point should you be looking at the sun without eye protection. So that's the big don't. Don't look directly at the sun. Do make sure that your eyes are protected in some way.
And when you say that, you don't mean sunglasses.
Right. Do not use regular sunglasses. That will not be enough to protect your eyes. If you're getting close to totality and it's even 99.9%, still do not look directly at the sun. That can still damage your eyes. So do be careful, though. You can use eclipse glasses. So these are glasses that will filter out a majority of the sunlight so you can safely look at the sun. Other options are a welder's glass 14. Only a 14, nothing lower, should be used. If it's an auto-darkening one, don't use that either. Only something that is labeled a welder's glass 14. Other options are to create projections of the sun. Those are also safe to view the sun. So you don't want to look up at the sun with a pinhole projection. You want to have the sunlight go through it and hit the ground or a piece of paper and look at that projection there. And you don't need a very tiny hole for that. I've seen people do it with Ritz crackers. The holes in between tree leaves is enough. That'll project it onto the ground. Or a piece of paper with a hole punched out. Just let the sun shine through that and do a projection onto the ground, and you'll be able to see that crescent shape.
You know, I recall in the early 60s, am I thinking 1962 or 1963, my parents making a pinhole camera for us to watch the eclipse. And I can still see, I think we held a piece of paper in my hand, or they did, and then one up to have the sun go through that hole. Is that what we did?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the pinhole camera.
Mm-hmm.
What about taking pictures, Shannon? What are the do's and don'ts? Everybody wants to get that smartphone up and take pictures of everything. If it hurts our eyes, can it hurt our cameras?
Yes, it will. It will probably hurt your electronic devices as well. And if you want to take pictures, you need to make sure that you also have solar filters on the primary lens of your camera. And even then, during totality, if you happen to be in the path, don't bother trying to take pictures. There's astrophotographers who've seen several of these that will be taking plenty. You really need to be focusing on the eclipse itself and not messing with technology, because you do not want to miss a second of this.
What times are we talking about here in Michigan? When might we expect to see things starting? It's not only just 2 minutes, right? It's a process.
Right. So the whole eclipse itself, from start to finish, from when the moon first starts to cover the sun to when it ends, is roughly 2-2.5 hours. So for East Lansing, which is what we know more specifically, it starts exactly at 1 p.m. The point of greatest eclipse is 2:24, and it will end at 3:45. And those will be similar times for most of Michigan. But if you want exact numbers for your location, websites like timeanddate.com would be able to give that for you for your exact location.
Plug that right in. So where will you be, and what will you be doing Monday when you're making that happy Kermit on the on the meme?
The plan, we hear that traffic is going to be pretty bad, but the plan right now is I will be in Salem, Oregon.
Right there.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be great. What drew you to astronomy? I'm wondering what you love about it.
One of the things that I love about astronomy is that it's something that everyone can go do and participate in. We can all go outside and look up at the stars. We can all go outside and look up at the planets and the sun. I think this is a particularly great example of that. This is something that's bringing the country together in many ways. So part of the reason I'm going to Salem is I'm going to go see my family out in the Northwest and one of my best friends who's out there. And a lot of our staff at the planetarium are also traveling to visit family or visiting them along their way to get to the eclipse. So this is a chance to bring us all together to watch a really phenomenal event, and it's all up in the sky. In this case, you do need eye protection, but there's nothing terribly expensive that you need in order to go outside, look outside, and enjoy the stars.
And remind us again, the next time we're going to have a chance at a total solar eclipse in America will be?
The next total solar eclipse across the continental United States is going to be April 8th, 2024, and that's a path from Texas to Maine.
Well, I'm just saying, without giving anything away, I guess I better try to catch this one. Dr. Shannon Schmoll directs the Abrams Planetarium at Michigan State University. Very excited about the upcoming Great American Eclipse, and enjoy that trip to Oregon and being right there in the path of totality. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Vern Ehlers, a research physicist who served 17 years representing Grand Rapids in Congress, has died. He was 83. Speaking at the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 2010, the Republican, who called himself the accidental congressman, encouraged other scientists to run for office. Here's a clip from that speech in which Ehlers compared the number of attorneys and business people who go into politics to the number of scientists like him.
And the attorney said, elect me and I will write good laws. And the businessman said, elect me and I will balance the budget. And I said, you know, every night I've been listening to these, my colleagues saying they would write good laws and they would balance the budget. And I've never claimed that I would do anything like that. But I do want you to know that I am a scientist. And I checked with the Library of Congress today, and I discovered that there are 175 attorneys in the House of Representatives. And somehow it seems to me that electing one more isn't really going to improve the quality of the laws. And I said, and then I checked on the businessmen, 138 businessmen. And it seems to me that electing one more is not going to help balance the budget. But I promise if you elect me, you will double the number of scientists in the Congress. And huge applause. This was on live TV. Never again did I hear the attorneys or the businessmen explain why they should be elected.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Vision.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Our infrastructure is our collective ability to say what we care about.
Think about a hot August day. Your car has been sitting out in a parking lot for hours and hours. And then think about how hot it is when you get inside and you touch that steering wheel. What if you could take all of that solar energy and use it for something besides burning your hands and keep your car cool at the same time? That's exactly what's going to happen at Michigan State University, a creative way to generate power and provide shade for parked cars. Here to tell us more about this is Dr. Wolfgang Bauer, who's a professor of physics at MSU and senior consultant with the Office of the Executive Vice President. Welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you very much.
What is this idea, then, to harness solar power and keep cars in the shade?
We're talking about solar arrays over five of our large parking lots. They're carport canopies. And the roof of these is just made out of solar panels.
How many?
We are talking about roughly 5,000 parking spaces that would be covered. These parking lots, there are five parking lots together with an area of about 45 acres.
That's pretty major. That's a large amount of space. So basically it's win-win because you've got something shading the cars, and meantime the university can tap into that solar energy.
That's correct. And in the winter, it keeps the snow off the cars, too, which is not an insignificant side benefit.
Absolutely. Tell us again, how many cars should be able to park under these solar panel parking bays?
It will be roughly 5,000. And, you know, to be honest, keeping the sun off the cars is not the main motivation. The main motivation is to build these solar arrays and preserve land that could be otherwise used for agricultural purposes.
So rather than putting panels elsewhere, so this is kind of just a pleasant side effect of being able to harness the solar power. You're just covering parking spaces.
That's correct. And this can be replicated at malls and schools, everywhere. What we're showing is that solar technology has progressed far enough that it could be used up in the northern part of the country where we live in Michigan. And it can be used to economic benefit. We believe that sustainability is not just sustainability in terms of greenhouse gas emissions and renewable energy, but it also has to be sustainable in a financial sense. We were very careful to plan this system that the electricity that it delivers to us will actually be cheaper than the electricity that we could buy off the electrical grid that's generated with fossil fuels.
So the solar installation can save the university money.
Yes, so we have a 25-year expected lifetime of these panels before we need to replace them. And during those 25 years, we project we will save roughly $10 million in electricity expenses.
And I'm wondering, as far as how much power can be generated by these solar panel parking bays, by what percent do you expect these new parking bays to increase the amount of electricity created by solar panels on MSU's campus?
Right now, we only have a few hundred kilowatt of solar panels on our campus, and this new system comes in at 13.4 megawatt direct current, which translates into 10.5 megawatt alternating current, the stuff that you get out of the sockets in the wall. So this is about a thousandfold increase or so. Incidentally, this array is going to be the largest in the country, and from what we could find out, very likely also the largest in the world.
Now, here's an important question for alums. On football Saturdays, will they still be able to roll in with their RVs and tailgate when those solar bays go up?
Yes, that's actually a very important consideration for us. And we spent a little extra money to make the solar carports high enough that any vehicle can go under it. So if you are able to go under a bridge in Michigan, you will also be able to go under our carports. The minimum clearing is 14 foot 6 inches. All the RVs and also the snow plowing equipment can easily go under those.
Now, MSU, as you've indicated, has a reputation for having staff and students who are proponents of clean energy. And certainly we've seen this movement to reduce fossil fuel use, this campus-wide focus on recycling and reuse. Do you think that culture helped this project become reality?
Oh, absolutely. We have many parts of our campus that are really actively working on making us greener. I mean, you know, our colors are green and white, right? So got to do this. And you got to do it for the good of the planet. The array will generate about 15,000 megawatt hours of electricity each year, which, you know, you may know that the average Michigan household consumes about 8.5 megawatt hours. So this array could provide all the electricity for about 1,800 Michigan households. And in terms of green energy savings, my rule of thumb is that each megawatt hour that you produce with coal-fired power plants is worth one tree. So one tree, if you plant a tree over its lifetime, it can absorb about as much carbon dioxide out of the air as the generation of one megawatt hour of coal-fired electricity emits. And we're producing 15,000 megawatt hours per year with this array, which means it's the equivalent of 15,000 trees per year. That's what we're doing for the environment. So it seems to me that putting the solar panels over parking lots is a win-win situation. You don't have to deforest. You don't have to spend agricultural land. You're keeping your cars cool in the summer and snow-free in the winter, and you're getting the renewable energy.
How doable is this, do you believe, for other institutions, for municipalities, office buildings? Is this a tough thing to put together?
I think once somebody shows that this can be done, not just efficiently, but also at monetary savings, many other institutions are becoming interested. So we've had a steady stream of visitors from airport authorities, other universities, municipal visitors, malls, that are all interested in copying our model. This can be done, and it can be done more and more efficiently.
When is everything expected to be up and operational?
The largest parking lot that we have is also the one that's most used for football parking. Football season starts here on September 2nd. We will have this parking lot completed by then, and all of the parking lots will be completed by the end of this calendar year.
Well, something to watch for next time you're at a game at Spartan Stadium and you see those big, tall, new parking bays, you're going to realize that it is part of a really terrific effort to harness that solar energy. Dr. Wolfgang Bauer of Michigan State University, thank you so much for sharing this and being a part of the next idea. And it'll be very exciting to see who else picks up on this effort that you've begun.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
Next year, we will choose a new governor. A number of candidates have already stepped into the race, including Democrat Bill Cobbs, formerly the global vice president for Xerox, who has declared he is ready to lead this Michigan revival. Bill Cobbs, welcome. Glad to
Thank
have you with
Cynthia.
Us.
Thank you, I'm glad to be here with you.
What kind of revival do you want to lead if you're elected governor?
Well, you know, today we have a state where public policy is not really being driven by the citizens. And we need to return to that because much of what happens today is not in the citizens' best interest.
So why did you decide to run for governor?
I remember growing up in a time when public education really provided a gateway to social mobility. And, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about our young people today and how different they are from us. And there's a fundamental reason they're different, and that reason is that the one thing that we had in my generation and generations that came after me was hope. Young people today don't have hope. They don't see a pathway to something else for themselves. So they default to what's easy. I want to create the opportunity for them to be able to have dreams that they can actually realize.
Now, you're a Navy veteran.
Yes.
You were the global vice president for Xerox, so tough business experience. But have you ever held elected office before?
Never even thought I would run for elected office.
So with that in mind, you know there are voters who have watched a non-politician businessman as governor of Michigan, a non-politician businessman right now at the White House, and people might have some reservations about someone with no experience in government as our state's chief executive. How do you answer that?
So unlike a lot of people, I don't think that you run government like you run a business. And, you know, I always take exception to the fact when people refer to me as a businessman. What I was someone who entered the business world to make sure that I could provide an opportunity and a decent living for my family. I made a living that way. That doesn't characterize who I am as a person. Governing is really about providing leadership, providing vision, being able to develop a plan that's executable, and having the conviction to see it through to the end. And those are things that I know a great deal about. You know, having had the opportunity in my life to actually work on a factory floor, to serve in the United States Navy, to be a police officer, I learned what it meant to be able to follow. And if you don't know how to follow, you'll never learn how to lead.
I'd like to get your thoughts, Bill Cobbs, on some of the issues that are facing Michigan. And let's start with people in Flint, with adults and children still being forced to have to use bottled water, facing lifelong health consequences and challenges from being exposed to that lead poisoned water. What do you think the state should do for them?
So as you know, last Saturday we had a candidate forum in Flint. And I've always been on record as saying that the state of Michigan has a responsibility to provide the services that are necessary to make Flint whole again. And from a health perspective, we don't know how long that'll take. There shouldn't be any limit placed on it. We need to step up to what the implications of the situation we created are. I've also said that we have a governor today that talks about having almost $1 billion in a rainy day fund. If Flint doesn't qualify as a rainy day, whatever will in the state?
So you're saying whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes is what we should be committed to. Because frankly, you know, Flint is not an anomaly. It's a perfect example of what the future of this state may look like if we don't begin to immediately address the infrastructure issues that are plaguing us as a state.
We have all watched as President Trump and Republicans in Congress have tried to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which means there are people here in Michigan at risk of losing their health care coverage, especially those who got their coverage through Medicaid, through Healthy Michigan. What would you do about this as governor?
Well, I think, obviously, from my perspective, I would love to be able to move to a single-payer model in the state of Michigan. And over time, I think we can do that. But we've got to fundamentally restructure some things before we can get there. I absolutely believe in the model of ACA. I happen to be a beneficiary of it because, you know, one of the things that ACA did was remove lifetime caps. If there were still a lifetime cap on what insurers had to provide, I would be up a creek without a paddle. So I understand that.
What kinds of restructuring things do you think need to be done?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that for us to move to a single-payer model, we've got to have a revenue-generating engine that allows us to pay for it. Today, we have a situation where in Michigan we have a very archaic tax policy. That tax policy, as it relates to citizens, is a fixed tax that penalizes people who make little money and benefits folks that make a lot of money. So I'd love to have a constitutional amendment that allows us to move from that fixed tax to a progressive tax structure so that we'd have the revenue coming into the state that we need to get the work done.
Think you can get that through a Republican-led legislature?
Well, I'm going to make every effort to have that happen. Because, you know, one of the things that I did when I created my platform was to try to focus on issues that crossed party lines, that weren't things that people could take partisan issue with.
We have seen job growth in Michigan, but labor participation's down. Wages are not going up at the same rate as corporate profits are. And too many Michiganders are cobbling together a living by having to work two or more jobs with few, if any, benefits. What can and should a governor be doing about that?
So one of the things I've said I'm going to do as the next governor of this state is implement a statewide infrastructure replacement program. That's a program that'll run 25 years minimum. That program will allow us to not only deal with all of our infrastructure issues, and I'm not just talking about roads, I'm talking about water, I'm talking about bridges and dams and electrical, as well as providing broadband access for citizens all across the state. But the collateral benefit that we'll get from that is the ability to create enough jobs in this state that will allow us to put any citizen who wants to work in a job that pays a living wage, probably a minimum $17.50 an hour, for the next 25 years. That'll give us the opportunity to really go back and attack the things that we've done to destroy our education system so that we're preparing our citizens for real work opportunities of the future.
And putting paychecks in people's pockets.
That's right.
And fixing problems in Michigan's
Absolutely.
Infrastructure. You state you'll implement the highest level of ethics and transparency. Can you give us your thoughts about the increasing amount of dark money that funds political campaigns?
Well, you know, we just came off of the first campaign finance reporting. And, you know, I encourage citizens to take a very close look at those reports, because one of the things that we've got to fundamentally understand is that when people provide big money to a campaign, they're not doing it out of benevolence. They're not doing it because they don't expect something. They're buying access. And we can't afford to have people in Lansing at the legislative level or in the governor's office who are accountable to anybody but the citizens of the state.
How would you change things?
The first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to make sure that if I'm the next governor of this state, the governor's office will no longer be exempt from FOIA. There's nothing that happens in that office that the people of the state shouldn't be able to see or hear or review.
There are so many issues and so many problems that need to be addressed in Michigan. What is the one that most motivates you to get up and campaign every morning?
So I've said that we have a ton of issues in Michigan, but you can't deal with everything at one time. So when I was formulating my platform, I couldn't stop at one, so I had to come up with four. Those four things are really making sure we do fundamental education reform. And by that, I mean making sure that we develop a scheme to fully fund every single school district in this state to deliver the educational outcomes that we say are important to us. That's number one. Number two, that we develop a statewide infrastructure program, because that's going to give us the opportunity to attack the things that impact human life in the state and also to create real job opportunities. Third is we need a fair tax policy for the 21st century. We can't continue to tax citizens who make $20,000 a year at the same rate that we tax millionaires and billionaires. And fourth, and probably very important to the future of Michigan, is that we have a water and environmental policy that protects our most important resources for this generation and generations to come. We can't continue to play Russian roulette with 20% of the entire Earth's fresh water supply.
Bill Cobbs, Democratic candidate for governor of Michigan. Thank you so much for spending time with
us. Thank you for inviting me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Rusty Brock. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Tyler Scott. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.